This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, today we've got a great opportunity to hear about healthcare reform from two different sides of the coin, policy and practice. U.S. Senator Chris Dodd will join us for our Newsmaker Conversation segment. Senator Dodd, who chaired the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee this summer, is back in the spotlight.
Yes, he is. He's been working with Majority Leader Harry Reid and Senator Max Baucus to develop a bill that merges the interest of the Senate Finance and Health Committees. And now they'll be including the public option in the bill that goes to the floor of the Senate.
Great news.
So we look forward to hearing more from Senator Dodd on that front.
We look forward to that. And on the flip side, we're going to our neighboring state to see if the Massachusetts Healthcare Reform Initiative can help inform the national dialogue. We'll speak with John Kingsdale, the executive director of the state's Independent Health Insurance Connector Authority. 3 years ago, the state enacted a law to mandate insurance for all. Margaret, it's gotten pretty close to its goal. Only 2.6% of its residents remain uninsured.
Wow. That is about close to the levels in most European nations who already have developed universal coverage. Let's hear what he says works and what still needs to happen to achieve true universal coverage.
But first, we'd like to share a comment that we got from one of last week's listeners. We heard from David Alward, the first executive director of mHealth Alliance, a partnership recently formed by the United Nations Foundation to facilitate global innovation in the field of mobile health. David was interested in last week's show on telehealth and our conversations with Dr. Blumenthal, President Obama's National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. David wanted to know how the federal government is connecting key data from electronic health records to the 911 and EMS system. He says this initiative would help create public demand and use of EHRs if the data was used to help save lives in emergencies.
What a great idea. And David, we'll be forwarding your comments to Dr. Blumenthal's office, and we'll also be tracking your progress for a future show. If you have feedback on our show, email us at conversations@chc1.com. We love to hear from you. Now let's get to an update on healthcare headlines from our producer, Lucy Nalpathanchil.
I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil with this week's headline news. As Margaret mentioned, the public option will be debated on the Senate floor. That's because Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has announced he will include a government-run insurance plan in the merged Finance and Health Committee bills. Reid's announcement to bring back the public option comes with a catch. The Senate provision will allow states to opt out of participating in the government-run insurance plan. This plan serves as a compromise between liberals who want a single-payer system and moderates who support a smaller government role in healthcare reform. Republicans have vowed to filibuster, so Reid must gain support from all Democrats and two independents in the Senate to have the necessary 60 votes to include the public option in a final Senate bill. U.S. Senator Chris Dodd has been working with Majority Leader Reid over the last several weeks. Mark and Margaret asked Senator Dodd about the next steps in hammering out a final bill.
Senator, thank you for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you both very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Great, and welcome, Senator Dodd. You have been such a key and pivotal player in the work of health reform this year. Can you give us a sense of the progress towards a final bill and also a sense of timing? What can Americans expect in the coming weeks?
The office called the Congressional Budget Office, which does something to every bill around here. They call scoring it. They actually try to determine what each provision would cost or what each provision would raise in revenues, as some do, and then determine what the overall cost would be to the American taxpayer. And so while we have scores on both of the bills, the bill that I managed this summer and the bill out of the Finance Committee, when you merge them, and there's some differences that are merging here as a result of the merger, then you want to get a score on those from the Congressional Budget Office. That could take several more days. I don't want to rush this. We want to get it done, obviously, but you want to be able to go to the floor of the United States Senate having good numbers, numbers that you can rely on, and good policy positions to present to your colleagues. Not that it won't be controversial. I expect this to be a lengthy debate on the floor of the Senate for the next easily 2 months, as people who are opposed to this, and many are on the Republican side of the aisle, are going to be raising probably hundreds of amendments to this bill. So it could be a lengthy process.
Speaking of controversy, the most recent polls, CNN and the Washington Post ABC, show that the majority of Americans support a public option. Around 60% of Americans say it should be a fundamental component of the bill, but it wasn't included in the legislation passed by the Senate Finance Committee. Why is there such a disconnect, and what are the fears of those opposed to the public option?
We have public options in Medicaid and Medicare and VA care and what's called TRICARE. So we've already established how valuable that can be for sectors of our population. The public option here, all we're really saying about it is if you want to keep costs down, which I all do, I presume we all understand how important it is, given the escalating costs, healthcare costs rises 5 times faster than wages in our country. And if we do nothing, by the way, if we do that which those are arguing for, and they say, just leave this alone, leave it for a later date, we're told by experts that that cost of $12,000 a year in the next 7 years in Connecticut and across the country would jump to close to $25,000 a year in premium costs for the private carriers. Obviously, that's unacceptable. You can't sustain that. So the public option brings down costs, one, we know that, and secondly, provides options. You know, we all like options. I'm a federal employee. I get about 23 options a year as part of the Federal Employees Health Benefit Package. Now, I'm not suggesting everyone get 23 options, although, frankly, I like having those options. In many states, in many jurisdictions, one or two insurance companies so dominate the market that there are no choices or very limited choices. The public option would provide people with additional choice, and that is as American as apple pie.
Senator, speaking of changes, one really quite radical change that looks like it will be part of a final bill is the elimination of pre-existing conditions as a grounds for denying coverage. Now, from our perspective as healthcare organizers and providers, this alone has the potential to reduce a lot of misery and suffering by families who've been priced out of health insurance when they need health care the most. That was a big step to take, and it seems clear that the trade-off for the insurers would be to require almost everybody to have health insurance. Can you comment on how you achieve this?
Yeah, and it's absolutely critical, and you're right, because we do require that people have health insurance. And again, we're all benefited by that when people do, as a result of more people being involved and having insurance, getting it when you're hopefully not ill or not sick in any way. Then obviously that allows for money to build up so that when claims do occur, there are the resources to take care of them. And by doing so, we can have the market reforms that allow for free screenings, free physicals, doing away with what you call the pre-existing condition, which is correct. And that is they can't all of a sudden drop you or raise your rate without any reason whatsoever because you all of a sudden have a condition. That's when you expand and increase the number of people and it spread out the risk. Then obviously that makes it possible to have these elimination of the prohibition on portability and pre-existing conditions. So everyone benefits from that. And as you do that, that also brings down cost as well. And when you have things like screenings and physicals, as many of you may know, and went through that prostate surgery this summer, I discovered early that I had a very spiked PSA rating, which is one indicator of prostate cancer. So I had that operation. Now, it was not inexpensive to get an operation, open surgery, and get it done. But had I not discovered it, and had it gone on longer, had it gotten to my lymph nodes or my blood or my bones, that operation could have easily cost $250,000 rather than the very reduced cost it was because I caught it early. So having screenings, having physicals, these are great ways not only to serve your health and keep you alive and keep you healthy, but also reduce costs tremendously.
Senator, the president has said that he believes that this health bill needs to be bipartisan, reflecting all Americans. You've had extraordinary success in bringing about bipartisan support. You did it in the passage of the Family Medical Leave Act and in the Helping Families Save Their Home Act. Not only bipartisan support, but very conservative support. What's going to take to get the final health reform legislation with all members of both parties joining in? And is it possible in this political climate?
Well, I hope so. And maybe your last point is the one that's the most important. We are, you know, this politics is always involved. It'd be foolish to suggest otherwise. But I think there's been so much misinformation about a lot of this that it's polarizing people, and that hurts. Part of the job in the coming days will be to reach out and listen to each other. We finished our bill in July. It ended up having a partisan vote at the end. It was a 13-10 vote in the health committee on which I was acting as the acting chairman. But I must tell you as well that we considered 300 amendments over five weeks and 23 sessions during that time. 161 of those 300 amendments were offered by my friends on the Republican side of the aisle that we accepted. More than half of the amendments that were adopted in that bill, very good ideas, but they contributed substantially to the product. We're a better bill today because they offered those amendments. And I was, again, I'm not suggesting they liked everything in the bill, nor did I for that matter, as the chairman of the committee. But I was disappointed we didn't come out of that committee with some bipartisan support going forward. So my hope is we'll do that. But it is the means to the end. It's not the end in itself. And too often, I think we confuse those two.
This is Conversations on Healthcare, and we're speaking with United States Senator Chris Dodd about healthcare reform.
Senator, supposing this does pass by the end of the year, what kinds of changes will the average American see in their healthcare, and when do you think they'll see it?
Well, again, we haven't finalized the bill, so I got to be careful about saying exactly what's in this because you're still working on this. But the idea would be things done immediately, like closing that donut hole for older Americans, or at least a good part of it, providing for those paying for immediate free screenings and physicals so people can start to identify problems they may have or have a sense of security in moving forward. A lot of these provisions will take some time over a series of years before you can kick in everything. Because it will. We're fundamentally altering and changing something that's been around now for 70 or 80 years. We're trying to keep the program alive, so if you like what you have, you like the insurance you have with your private carrier, we're not mandating that you leave that. We're trying to help small employers as well so that they get treated fairly with the cost of health care. They've been paying 18% more for health care costs than other larger employers. We're trying to eliminate that. Individuals, self-employed people, to allow for pooling so that they can obviously get reduced costs and spread out the risk and therefore become health insurance more available to them.
Senator Chris Dodd, thank you so much for speaking with Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you both.
As we wait to see how federal lawmakers shape healthcare reform for the nation, some say the state of Massachusetts could be a model for reform. In 2006, the state passed landmark legislation to achieve near-universal coverage for all residents. The plan includes an individual insurance mandate and called on the public and private sectors to share in the financial responsibility of the plan. It also expanded the state's Medicaid program. 3 years later, Somerville, Massachusetts resident and graduate student, 26-year-old Eric Gray, is one of the residents who's benefiting from the plan. He works as an independent contractor for an education agency and doesn't have insurance through his employer.
And it would be far more expensive if I had to buy a plan, you know, directly from one of those providers instead of through the Mass Health Connector.
The Massachusetts Health Connector is the independent state authority that promotes the reform plan. It helps residents choose between two options, the Commonwealth Care Plan, which is a subsidized government insurance program for individuals with income below 300% of the federal poverty level, or Commonwealth Choice, an insurance exchange of private plans for residents to choose from. Gray has an insurance plan from the exchange that he chose by applying online.
It's sort of a one-stop shop for all the different plans from the different companies, and they have the HMOs, the PPOs, and very easy for me to find something that fit my budget and got the coverage that I wanted.
Over the last 3 years, the state has enrolled an estimated 430,000 people who were previously uninsured. Lindsay Tucker, health reform policy manager with the consumer advocacy group Healthcare for All, points to this number as an example of success.
We are no longer in any way the experiment. We are over 97% insured in our state, and we have approval ratings that are the envy of any politician. Well above 60% of the public support the law.
There have been problems with the reform plan. For one, the cost of health care in Massachusetts continues to increase. And two, all those newly insured residents have put pressure on an already squeezed primary care system. Dr. Alan Garol is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chair of Massachusetts Coalition for Primary Care Reform. He says a reform plan must also strive to improve quality of care.
If we're really going to fix health care in the country, and I think this is being recognized in federal legislation, we have to strengthen the primary care base at the same time, or even before, we expand health insurance to everybody.
The state has taken notice of these challenges, and just last summer, a special state commission was created to work on long-term cost control provisions. Massachusetts has also passed incentive programs to expand the primary care workforce, such as tuition reimbursement for medical students who enter primary care. Overall, there's widespread approval from the public, government leaders, and physicians for the plan to continue. A recent poll by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Harvard School of Public Health found that 70% of Massachusetts physicians support the law, and 75% want the law to remain in place. To find out more about Massachusetts' reform plan, Mark and Margaret spoke with John Kingsdale, executive director of the state's Health Connector, an independent authority that promotes coverage of the uninsured.
John, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Welcome, John. How has this past year's state and national economic crisis impacted the reform effort for you in Massachusetts?
We've actually weathered it pretty well. When I say we've weathered it, I mean healthcare reform has, and we've been able to maintain a good coverage for most of the folks who are beneficiaries of state reform. We just had a state survey result that show virtually unchanged level of coverage. So again, more than 97% of residents in Massachusetts are covered. And but we're certainly under pressure to save money wherever we can. And I think, frankly, the biggest impact has been on some of the Medicaid payment rates because with the maintenance of effort requirements under the federal stimulus package, there's very little that the Medicaid program, again, outside of reform, just the state's Medicaid program can do to save money other than to look at payment rates. So that's actually been a significant issue.
Massachusetts has the lowest percentage of uninsured residents in the country at 2.6%. First of all, congratulations. You've credited that success to the individual mandate. Tell us why the mandate plays such a powerful role in Massachusetts' success and, by extension, I assume, in the national reform efforts.
The mandate really has two separate and critically important consequences. One, of course, is it gets folks' attention and it motivates a lot of people to sign up for insurance. And the second sort of consequence of it, though, is that it's actually by bringing folks into the risk pool, into the insurance, who consider themselves healthy, who are maybe an accident or a diagnosis away from needing significant medical care, but are willing to take that risk. We've actually been able to reform the insurance market in such a way as to actually bring prices down for individuals who buy insurance. So we literally had a 20% plus reduction overnight in the price of buying insurance directly on your own as a result of reforms that include the mandate.
We've been following your efforts to now address costs through your new special cost commission. But what can you tell us about better health outcomes or any savings that Massachusetts has realized through decreased admissions to hospital for preventable conditions, for instance?
Well, I wish, Margaret, I could tell you more. We know that a significant increase in the number of residents here who report a routine a source of care, a primary care clinician, as a consequence of reform. We know that we've got reduced financial barriers to appointments, filling prescriptions, access to care. But for somebody to be able to see a detectable change in the overall health status of the population, when frankly 90% of health status is a function of income and environment and inheritance and so forth, because we've got another 6, 7, 8% of our population insured, that's going to take years, frankly. So I can't cite a statistic that says, you know, folks in Massachusetts are living longer or infant mortality is down or anything like that.
John, under the law, residents must have insurance through their employer or by enrolling in the state's subsidized plan, Commonwealth Care, or through the private insurance exchange, Commonwealth Choice. But what about the person who can't get it through their employer, doesn't qualify for a subsidy, or just can't afford to purchase insurance on their own?
Well, that's a real problem, and you know, we would like to be at 99 or 100% insured. I think a lot of European countries have, you know, universal insurance, but still 1 or 2% uninsured, and at 2.6, 2.7 for this past year, that rate's very, very good, but it's not 100%, and we got to figure out a way, I think, when the economy recovers, see if we can't, to use a strained analogy, put the ball across the last 2 or 3 yards that remain on the field.
You know, we talked about primary care a moment ago and the fact that as more people became insured, they begin to utilize health services, and this is a good thing. We want people to choose a primary care provider if they haven't had one and to use that primary care provider for their health care. But didn't this pent-up demand, if you will, put a lot of stress on the system and show that there really just weren't enough primary care providers, especially maybe as you got out into the more rural western part of the state? How has Massachusetts addressed this?
Good question, because the shortage of primary care is a national problem. There are particular pockets of shortage in the Berkshires and in the Cape and the Islands. And one of the great things about reform has been that once, frankly, we get public policy on the move so that leaders and providers and government officials are concern to make something that they've invested a lot of resources in, a bold experiment, a work, they have actually been even more open than normally to looking at the consequential issues, such as the cost issue, which we're paying a lot of attention to, and the issue of access to primary care. And so we've seen two very concrete changes already, and I expect we'll see more in Massachusetts.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. We're speaking with John Kingsdale, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Health Connector, an independent authority established by the state to promote coverage of the uninsured. John, with attention on Capitol Hill to pass national health care reform this year, some have said Massachusetts' reform plan could be the model for the nation. But you noted in your testimony to the United States Senate that anything so ambitious as reforming one-sixth of our economy cannot be captured in a single piece of legislation, but involves some degree of trial and error, learning by doing. So is it fair to say that your recommendation would be to get the coverage piece first and then go to controlling cost?
I do think that the important thing is to get movement, to get off the dime. And if access is all that they can do, that's critically important because, frankly, we don't have a national health cost containment policy right now. We don't have anything other than every recession we get 5 or 10 million more uninsured. And I think, we've found in Massachusetts nationally, if we stop the sort of the cost containment policy that says we'll just have more uninsured, it's actually going to add to the momentum to address costs squarely. So I hope Washington will do both, but at a minimum, we have to deal with the moral issue of covering people.
And let me follow up on that question about addressing cost. One model of interest is the state of Maryland's model on controlling hospital costs. And there they've shown over really quite a long period of time now that cost control regulation has driven down hospital costs far below the national average and still maintained a strong hospital system. Is this a model of control that you think might be useful in our national reform dialogue?
Well, I'm going to look internationally here for a minute. You know, every society that has universal coverage, every advanced economy has some form of national rate setting or a public program that sets rates. And a lot of the issues that we deal with on cost are not about overutilization. They're really about the cost of producing a day in the hospital or a visit or a pill. So whether it's rate setting or some kind of more effective competition, I think all those options should be on the table. And we should be looking very carefully at states like Maryland that seem to have done a very good job.
Conversations on Healthcare focuses on innovations in the nation's health care delivery system. What future innovations excite you, or whose work should we be keeping an eye on?
Well, I think that the conversion, if you will, of greatest need, medical need, from acute care, which we've done a pretty good job in this country at addressing, to chronic illness, is got to capture the attention of the innovators, whether it's more continuous contact by telephone and electronic medical records with folks who have long-term chronic requirements for communication and access and monitoring, or at group models of delivering care for folks with chronic illness. I think we've got to find a way, and I'm very excited that we are at places like Kaiser and elsewhere finding new ways to deal with chronic illness in a population.
John Kingsdale, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Health Connector, thank you for speaking with us today.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week, we focus on a program that uses an interactive garden classroom to teach kids about the importance of nutrition and building community.
In 1995, an abandoned lot adjacent to the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School in Berkeley, California, was transformed into a one-acre garden. It became the Edible Schoolyard, the brainchild of Chef Alice Waters, who many credit with starting the local food movement. Through her nonprofit, Chez Panisse Foundation, the garden space helped change public education by integrating gardening, cooking, and the sharing of a daily lunch into the core curriculum. Using math, science, and the humanities, the Edible Schoolyard teaches 1,000 middle school students each year through hands-on lessons about growing vegetables, fruits, herbs, and flowers. What's the goal? The Edible Schoolyard not only teaches young people about creating and sustaining an organic garden, but they also learn how to prepare, serve, and eat food that's good for them. This is especially relevant when, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, nearly 1 in 3 children are either overweight or obese. These life lessons are taught through cooperative work and positive interactions with their teachers, community volunteers, and their peers. The interactive program reaches several hundred visitors a year and has helped launch affiliate programs in New Orleans and other cities across the country. Are you interested in planting a garden or a kitchen program in your school? Go to edibleschoolyard.org. The Edible Schoolyard, educating students about the connections between food choices and the health of themselves and their communities. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community